Welcome again to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp. I'm in studio with my wife Jean and also with Kim Kennedy. We're going to bring you more information on the flag in our first segment, the evolution of the flag, both in why it looks the way it does. We're continuing with that, but then also the evolution of the meaning of the flag. What does it mean to each individual and how does it differ along the way? We started out several weeks ago with the St. George's Cross, the red cross on the white flag, and continued through up to the Revolution, where we had the Betsy Ross flag, or the first four stars and stripes, had 13 stripes and 13 stars. We also did last week, we discussed the Star-Spangled Banner. That was the 15-star, 15-stripe flag. First Flag Act said one stripe for every state and one star for every state, realizing that it would almost look like a corduroy suit with so many stripes as it progressed through the number of states that were added. It was dropped back to 13 stripes for the original 13 colonies and one star for each of the states. As we finished off last week, we finished off the Civil War. Tremendous amount has happened in the time so far with the numbers of people that have committed their lives to defending this country and its inception and its growth and its preservation. Following the Civil War, we had the War of 1812. And following that, we're continuing forward, looking at World War I, 156,000 casualties in World War I. World War II, we suited up 16 million and we lost 413,000. I think that World War II was the last war that we really fought to win. We fought enemies on two fronts. We fought Germany in the European theater, and we fought Japan in the Pacific. In a four-year time frame, we defeated both of these enemies. Everyone in the country really was in the war. There were no cars made in Detroit at the time. The auto industry shut down and converted to making tanks and trucks and vehicles and everything to support the war effort. Everyone in the country was on ration stamps, whether it be meat ration or gas ration. Everything was converted to the effort of the war. People had victory gardens. There were drives to collect metal for the war effort. People were collecting scrap metal each week and giving that to support the effort. So I look at that today it evolved to something different, and how did that happen? I always say that if Dan Rather were on the beach at Normandy on June 6th of 1944, the war would have been over in 2 weeks and everybody would be home and we'd be speaking German doing the goose step right now, because there was a tremendous amount of loss in the war effort itself. Like I say, 413,000 killed. Finally, the war ended. VE Day, Victory in Europe, was May the 8th of 1945. That's when Germany surrendered. The war in the Pacific was still raging at that time. Finally, the Japanese surrendered on September the the second is actually the VJ Day celebration. They surrendered on the 14th of August, and then September 2nd is when we had the ceremonial signing in Tokyo Bay on the deck of the Missouri. We know it as VJ Day, Victory in Japan. In Europe and in Australia, they know it as VP Day, Victory in the Pacific. So following through with that, we now go to Korea. And Korea is when things got a little bit shaky, and the fact that it was never really a declared war. It was more of a police action declaration. And we still have the issues open with Korea, so that we never really finalized that. More than 50,000 killed there. Again, more commitment to preserving our nation. The wheels really fell off when we hit Vietnam. We no longer fought that war on the battlefield. We fought that in our living rooms. We fought that on the television. And with that, We actually won that multiple times, but we walked away. We got the peace treaty, and we lost the peace. We won the battles, but we effectively were perceived as losing that. We had talked about the veterans of Vietnam. We have a tremendous number of customers at our store in Marchwood at Brandywine Flags that are veterans. And whenever we see a veteran, we always shake their hand and say, thank you for your service. When we see a Vietnam vet, it's thank you for your service and welcome home, because no one welcomed them home. Perhaps their mother was the only person that said welcome home, or some other member of the family, but they were despised. And it was just a terrible thing that we as a government sent them to fight this in the jungles, and then we despised them when they came back as if it were their fault, like they wanted to do this. So as we move forward again to the Gulf Wars, we had some tremendous victories under Norman Schwarzkopf under the first Gulf War. And then we got bogged down in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're still there in both instances. But when we look at the total number of men and women that committed everything, all gave some and some gave all. A lot of them gave all. And the flag itself has significant meaning as a result of that. So when you see a flag, you may have some kind of a feeling towards that. But when you look at a veteran or others that have seen it fly in very difficult situations, it's a different story. So when we look at the flag today, we have 13 stripes alternating red and white, and we have 50 stars. The stars represent each of the states that we have in the United States today. So when do you add a star? The star is added on the 4th of July following the admission to statehood. So we started out with a 13-star flag that was designed with a circular pattern of stars and the alternating stripes. And today we now have the field of blue in the upper left, and it's a rectangular pattern of stars. They're five-pointed. 50 stars. We added the 50th star on the July 4th of 1960 with the admission of Hawaii. We added the 49th star on the 4th of July of 1959 with the admission of Alaska. We added the 47th and the 48th star on July 4th of 1912 with the admission of both Arizona and New Mexico. So we never did have a 47-star flag. A lot of times people will come into our store and say, my house was built in such a year, what flag would I fly? We have every flag pattern of every star pattern is available to be flown, whether it be the 13 star, the 27 star flag from 1845 to 1846, or the 34 star flag from 1861 to 1863. Doesn't really matter, which is really kind of cool. So. If there's ever an interest from anyone to say, hey, I'd like to get a flag that is appropriate to fly at the time my house was built, these flags are available. Prior to the Revolution, you would either be flying the British Red Ensign, which came here during the colonization, or you would more than likely fly the Betsy Ross. With the flag, it's another issue of how do I treat it now? How do I show the respect? Public humiliation is a terrible fear that people have. That's why you don't have people that will stand up in front of a group and speak. They're afraid of being embarrassed. So public embarrassment is a task that we've got to overcome. But when you see someone that is acting inappropriately, it's not really all that bad to maybe cause them to feel a little bit of embarrassment. When a flag passes you in a parade, you want to stand. Men would remove their hats. Don't put your hat over your heart. You put your hat over your left shoulder so that your hand is over your heart. This shows respect, and there's so little of that shown anymore. The national anthem is being played. You stand at attention, and you show respect. You also, as military, you would salute. You have your hand over your heart when they're playing the national anthem. You're at a sporting event. You see little kids running around during the playing of the national anthem. Just say, excuse me, they're playing the national anthem. Can you show a little respect? And it's not like people try to disrespect the flag. So often, they just don't even realize what they're doing. It's not something where they think, gee, I'd like to show the disrespect. They just don't know how to show proper respect. And we just ask that you reconsider that the next time a flag passes, the next time you hear the national anthem. We just ask that you do respect those veterans and thank them, because all they're really looking for is a thank you. And oftentimes when we'll say thank you for their service, all they say is, well, I was just doing my job. And it was a heck of a job that they did, because we now have this country intact, even though we have some difficult times ahead and we are going through some difficult times right now. I think that the American spirit is going to live on, and we will prevail. We're going to go to a break now, folks, and when we come back, Gene is going to talk about Clarendon Piven and bring you up to speed on that. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to Raise the Standard. In this segment, I'm going to talk about the Clarendon-Piven strategy. Now, many people may have heard about this, but I don't think a lot of people really understand what it was all about. The Clarendon-Piven strategy was first proposed in 1966, and it was named after Columbia University sociologists Richard Andrew Cloward and Francis Fox Piven. The strategy seeks to hasten the fall of capitalism by overloading the government bureaucracy with a flood of impossible demands, thus pushing society into crisis and economic collapse. And what we're seeing today is just a continuation of that strategy. Clarendon Piven charged that the ruling classes use welfare to weaken the poor, that by providing a social safety net, the rich douse the fires of rebellion. Poor people can advance only when the rest of society is afraid of them. Rather than placating the poor with government handouts, the activists should work to sabotage and destroy the welfare system. The collapse of the welfare state would ignite a political and financial crisis that would rock the nation. Poor people would rise in revolt. Only then would the rest of society accept their demands. The key to sparking this revelation would be to expose the inadequacy of the welfare state. They noted that the number of Americans subsisting on welfare, about 8 million at the time, probably represented less than half the number who were technically eligible for full benefits. They proposed a massive drive to recruit the poor into the welfare rolls. Clarendon Piven calculated that persuading even a fraction of potential welfare recipients to demand their entitlements would bankrupt the system. The result they predicted would be a profound financial and political crisis that would unleash powerful forces for major economic reform at the national level. They had an article called Cadres of Aggressive Organizers to Use Demonstrations to Create a Climate of Militancy. Intimidated by threats of black violence, politicians would appeal to the federal government for help. Carefully orchestrated media campaigns carried out by friendly left-wing journalists would float the idea of a federal program of income redistribution. Sound familiar? We have the journalists today still supporting the liberal agenda and income redistribution that Obama talks about all the time is nothing new. And this income redistribution would be in the form of a guaranteed living income for all, working and non-working people alike. Local officials would clutch at this idea like drowning men to a lifeline. They would apply pressure to Washington to implement it. With every major city erupting into chaos, Washington would have to act. This was an example of what are commonly called Trojan horse movements, mass movements whose outward purpose seems to be providing material help to the downtrodden, but whose real objective is to draft poor people into service as revolutionary foot soldiers, to mobilize poor people en masse to overwhelm government agencies with a flood of demands beyond the capacity of those agencies to meet. And we're seeing a lot of that today. We saw that in the 60s and 70s, and as I said, it's still happening today. The flood of demands were calculated to break the budget, jam the bureaucratic gears into gridlock, and bring the system crashing down. Fear, turmoil, violence, and economic collapse would accompany such a breakdown, providing perfect conditions for fostering radical change. That was the theory.
Jean, this is very fascinating, and it helps me to understand, and I would like to know your and Michael's thoughts on this, that I pick up on indifference towards the unemployment situation in this country. It's not talked about anymore. It's like the forgotten subject. But for the average citizen, it's very much on the top list of concerns. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I remember thinking over the years that when were the liberals going to stand up and apologize for creating the welfare state, which, as we all know, destroyed the black family. And then as I've educated myself further, I realized that it wasn't a mistake that they made. This was all planned. They wanted to have this army of poor people who needed help from the government so that they could overpower the government with demands for food stamps, welfare, rent assistance, and so forth and so on, to bring this country down.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Because there was a day, and it wasn't that long ago, when working and being self-sufficient was a virtue.
Absolutely.
Do you guys hear that anymore? Or is it just me?
No, I think that today, if you can game the system, then that's something to be very proud of for a lot of people. And that was not the way it used to be, and that is not what made this country great. What made this country great was people who worked hard and wanted a piece of the American dream and were willing to make the sacrifices to get that dream fulfilled for them and their family.
Yeah, I have to agree with you guys on that. It's
disheartening.
Yes, and don't you think that's intentional?
Absolutely, absolutely intentional. That's exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to convince everybody that, you know, you didn't have to work hard and it didn't pay to be an entrepreneur, that you just sat back and let the government take care of you. It's called socialism. It's called communism. And that's what we're dealing with today.
Yes, I agree. Very insightful.
Anyway, to continue, Cloward and Piven recruited a militant black organizer named George Wiley, and he was to lead their new movement. In the summer of 67, Wiley founded the National Welfare Rights Organization, or the NWRO. His followers invaded welfare offices across the United States, often violently. They were bullying social workers and loudly demanding every penny to which the law entitled them. That's when that word started to come into the discussion. By 1969, NWRO claimed a dues-paying membership of 22,500 families and had 523 chapters across the nation. Regarding Wiley's tactics, there have been sit-ins in legislative chambers, including a United States committee hearing, mass demonstrations of several thousand welfare recipients, school boycotts, picket lines, mounted police, tear gas, arrest, and on occasion, rock throwing, smashed glass doors, overturned desks, scattered papers, and ripped out phones. These methods proved very effective.
Would these be the start of community organizers?
Bingo. Yes, yes. Where have we heard that term before? And from 1965 to 1974, the number of single-parent households on welfare soared from 4.3 million to 10.8 million, despite mostly flush economic times. So the economy was really good, but all of a sudden we have all these poor people surfacing. By the early 70s, one person was on the welfare rolls in New York City for every two working in the city's private economy. As a direct result of its massive welfare spending, New York City was forced to declare bankruptcy. In 1975, the entire state of New York nearly went down with it. The Cloward-Piven strategy had proved its effectiveness. The Cloward-Piven strategy depended on surprise. Once society recovered from the initial shock, the backlash began. New York's welfare crisis horrified America, giving rise to a reform movement which culminated in the end of welfare as we know it, and that in 1996, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, that's a mouthful, which imposed time limits on federal welfare along with strict eligibility and work requirements. Both Cloward and Piven attended the White House signing of the bill as guests of President Clinton. So that's when we started to have some kind of accountability to get welfare and a time frame. Most Americans to this day have never heard of Cloward Piven. But New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani attempted to expose them in the late 1990s. As his drive for welfare reform gained momentum, Giuliani accused the militant scholars by name, citing their 1966 manifesto as evidence that they had engaged in deliberate economic sabotage. This wasn't an accident, Giuliani charged in 1997. It wasn't an atmospheric thing. It wasn't supernatural. This is the result of politics and programs designed to have the maximum number of people get on welfare. In 1982, partisans of the Cloward Piven strategy founded a new voting rights movement, which purported to take up the unfinished work of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Like ACORN, the organization that spearheaded this campaign, the new voting rights movement was led by veterans of George Wiley's welfare rights crusade. So these people move right along with their agenda. Its flagship organizations were Project Vote and Human Serve, both founded in 1982. Project Vote is an ACORN front group launched by former NWRO organizer and ACORN co-founder Zach Paulette. Human Serve was founded by Richard A. Cloward and Francis Fox Piven, along with a former NWRO organizer named Hulbert James. Some of these names may be familiar to you, some of them may not. ACORN, Project Vote, and Human Serve set to work lobbying energetically for the so-called Motor Voter Law, which Bill Clinton ultimately signed in 1993. The Motor Voter Bill is largely responsible for swamping the voter rolls with dead wood, invalid registration signed in the name of deceased, ineligible, or non-existent people, thus opening the door to the unprecedented levels of voter fraud and voter disenfranchisement claims that followed in subsequent elections. Now, when you hear today, when we try to get the voter ID laws passed in all the states, you hear that there's no voter fraud and it's racist. They don't want black people to vote. And the Republicans are trying to affect the vote and get more people to vote for Republicans and squash the Democratic voters. And as you can see, that's just not true. The new Voting Rights Coalition combines mass voter registration drives, typically featuring high levels of fraud, with systematic intimidation of election officials in the form of frivolous lawsuits, unfounded charges of racism and disenfranchisement, as well as direct actions, as in street protest, violent or otherwise. Just as they swamped America's welfare offices in the 60s, Cloward Piven devotees now seek to overwhelm the nation's understaffed and poorly policed electoral system. Their tactics set the stage for the Florida recount crisis of 2000 and have introduced a level of fear, tension, and foreboding to U.S. elections hereto encountered mainly in third world countries. This continues to happen today. If you remember the Black Panthers who stood in front of the polls in Philadelphia and intimidated voters, and Eric Holder refused to do anything about it. Both the living wage and voting rights movements depend heavily on financial support from George Soros's Open Society Institute and his shadow party, through whose support the Cloward Piven strategy continues to provide a blueprint for some of the left's most ambitious campaigns today.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know.
Welcome back, folks. This is Kim Kennedy with Michael and Gene Rapp of Brandywine Flags here on WFYL 1180 AM. Raise the Standard is what you're listening to. We've had some very interesting topics so far. I just want to remind you, if you want to contact us with comments or questions about any of today's segment, please do so at info@1180WFYL.com. Michael, what are we picking up on this segment?
I just wanted to kind of follow up on the last segment that Gene had talked about, Cloward and Piven, that it sounds a lot to me like let's transform America. And it looks like we're succeeding at that. We bought into that on this past two elections, if you will, with the White House changing over to let's transform America into something different. And when I look back at history and the civilizations that were dominant in the world over the course of time, they lasted about 200 years. You look at Rome, you look at Greece, you look at Spain, you look at England, and then you look at the Native American Indians or you look at Scotland. The Native Americans fought amongst each other in tribes. You look at Scotland, and probably the most ferocious of fighters and loyal, most loyal people in the world, struggled breaking free from England, and they fought amongst each other in clans. And now I look at the point that we are fighting amongst ourselves. We are now the Native American relived. We are now Scotland, where the Constitution was adopted in 1787. 1987 was 200 years. So we're on borrowed time. And to transform America, I think, is the objective of Clarendon Piven. And I think that it's being carried forward with the White House right now, that they want to transform us into something else.
And I can't help but think, Michael and Jean, that the success of that is due in large part to so much misinformation that comes out of certain segments of the press. Your thoughts?
Not only that, it's a disinterest by a lot of American people. A lot of American people think that, you know, oh, it's politics. I don't care about that. I'm not, you know, it's not, it has nothing to do with me. Well, it has everything to do with you, your children, and your grandchildren.
Yeah, we've got to pay attention, and we're no longer paying attention. We have a 30-day time span or a 30-day attention span. If it doesn't happen in 30 days, we just move on to something else. It's like, no, I don't have time for that. I want instant gratification. It's frightening to think of what is this country going to look like over the next 10 or 20 years. I mean, look at what's happening in the world. Look at what happened in Libya and Denmark this past weekend. We've got all kinds of terroristic things that are happening. And the White House, they're now hosting a 3-day summit on countering violent extremism.
And I heard, Michael, that in the summit, Islamist terrorism, Middle Eastern extremists aren't on the agenda. Did you hear that?
Yes, I heard it as well.
Why does the White House refuse to acknowledge the truth and call this Islam extremism, which is what it is? In a statement, the White House even called the 21 Christians who were beheaded as Egyptian citizens. They could even acknowledge them as being Christians, refusing to identify them as Christians. The truth is that the barbaric murderers openly said that they killed them because they were people of the cross.
Mm.
So
that's right.
The terrorists are telling us what their agenda is. Why is the White House seemingly continuing to protect Islam and refusing to open his eyes to the truth? I don't understand that. These people are bent on destroying the West. They've already said that they want to fly the flag of Islam over the White House. It's like, if you don't want to get hit by the train, you don't stand on the tracks. We're straddling the rails.
And that's a great point, Michael and Jean. And while I see these groups, ISIS and others, moving in and taking advantage of the apathy of a dying Western culture, and they come in with the zeal as abhorrent as it is to us and evil, for so many of the younger generation who are lost in so many senses of the word, they see this zeal and they say, hey, these people have something that they're living for. They have a purpose, where so much of Western culture has lost that. And I wonder if that's the pull and the draw there. And I share your concern that while we're hearing and watching these things, there's no rallying call in the West to say, we've got to take a stand. Now's the time. And you keep looking for that. And I mean, there's pockets of it. What's your take on that?
It's that same attitude of, we're America, we're always going to be America, and nothing's going to change us. And that is not true. We have to pay attention to these things, and we're not. You use the word apathy. That's the key word. We're apathetic to this. Nobody's going to tell us what to do. We're going to do what we want to do, and we're going to live our lives the way
business
we want to live.
Business as usual? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, business as usual.
It kind of reminds me of Nazi Germany and the beginning of that reign of terror and the Holocaust, that so many Jewish people in the very beginning just thought, oh, it'll blow over, you know, and they just kind of stayed where they were and did what they were doing every day. And then when they realized what the problem was, it was too late.
That's one of my concerns. I mentioned in my last segment that we fought World War II to win, and we won. Now we're fighting a politically correct war, or all of the wars that we fought since then have been politically correct. And my concern is, when we get to a point where we have to fight to win, will we be so far down the road that we won't be able to do that? that it would be.
I think our military can rise to the occasion when it happens, and I think it will happen sooner or later. But our military is the greatest military in the history of civilization.
Agreed.
And if they were just left alone to do what they've been trained to do and what they do are capable of doing so well, they can beat any enemy.
We look at history repeats itself. What happened in Vietnam? We had the White House was calling all of the military action in Vietnam. They did not allow the commanders on the field. Johnson was calling the sorties. He was calling. Why didn't we allow the military to fight the military war? And the same thing is happening now. The military has not been allowed. The generals are all the Pentagon is at their wit's end. It's like why do you not allow us? You bring us in to develop strategies and to develop plans to achieve an objective, and we just don't want to do that. We want to have it as a politically correct signature, and that's it. And we now have community organizers that are running the military operations.
One thing that is even worse right now with this war is that Obama has infiltrated the military with people who will go along with his agenda, and he has retired, I think it's 70-some generals and an admiral or two who were experienced warriors who know how to run a war and but wouldn't go along with what he wants. And so we not only have a military that is begging to be let loose to do what they know how to do, we have a military that has been infiltrated by people that don't care and don't know how to fight a war, or at least they're all they're concerned with is being liked by Obama.
And do you mind me asking you guys if you've heard of that report from Representative Ellen West about some of our troops actually being put in harm's way on the battlefield?
Absolutely. And we have lost many, many military lives, brave men and women, and a lot of them have lost limbs and eyes, and they come home with PTSD because they are fighting with one arm tied behind their back and a manual in their pocket telling them what they can and can't do. And this is hurting their ability to fight this war effectively.
There are actually instances where prior to a mission, men and women will sit down with attorneys and they will determine what are the rules of engagement. What are you allowed to do? What are you allowed to accomplish here? And what can you not do?
That's crazy.
You're right. You're right. It's lead, follow, or get out of my way. it boggles my mind. And we're just sitting around allowing this to happen. We're watching it happen. Most people are watching Dancing with the Stars.
That's true, and that's a big part of the problem, not just Dancing with the Stars, the other reality shows and so forth.
Oh, very well said, Gene and Michael. Thank you. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Raise the Standard. In this segment, Michael is going to start off with some feedback and updating on Chris Kyle and that trial, and also the net neutrality situation that we're dealing with today.
Following up to last week's segment on Chris Kyle, the trial is underway right now. Eddie Ray Roth was the ex-Marine that shot both Chris and Chad Littlefield. And in the trial, there was a testimony by Taya, Kyle's wife, very emotional. It was an excellent testimony that she had given, bringing forth all of the things that that Chris had done, so forth. But what's disconcerting is the fact that Roth was overheard to have said, "I feel bad about it, but they wouldn't talk to me. I'm sure they've forgiven me." Here's a guy. He was sitting in the back seat, and Littlefield and Kyle were in the front seat. And they were driving to the it was a 90-mile trip to the range, and he was upset because they weren't talking to him in the back seat. Roth has pleaded not guilty. The attorneys are pursuing an insanity defense. They're saying that they feel that he was under a state of psychosis and really didn't know what he was doing. If convicted, he faces prison without parole. So we'll keep you updated on that as the trial concludes. Also, I think that we're going to be begging to go back to the future at some point if the net neutrality goes through. This is the bill that is up for vote on February 26th. It's the FCC. They're going to vote on net neutrality, and they're going to control, they want to control the internet and the flow of information. They're trying to take away our voice. They feel that they need to control the internet. Like all innovations, the internet wasn't created by the government, and the government really has no power to control it. They want to have the Department of the Internet, just like we have the Department of the Internal Revenue Service. Bloggers, citizens, these reporters will not be allowed to broadcast. They'll be a thing of the past. They're saying that they're not real journalists. So in looking at this...
What defines a real journalist, Gene and Michael? I'm just curious.
I guess a liberal media person that agrees with Obama and stands up for him and just backs him in everything he does.
And you look at the journalists, you know. We did a segment last week on Brian Williams. I mean, what a heck of a journalist he is. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. If you say it often enough, it becomes fact. Mm. It's discouraging. It's discouraging all the way around.
Not surprised to hear that and been reading about that. From my point of view, guys, when I hear news like that, one of the first things that I start to do is pray against these type of things. It's not the only thing, but it's a great start, is to go to the Lord, because the Lord ultimately loves freedom and hates to see liberties infringed upon. So we need to pray against this type of legislation.
Yes, we certainly do.
Do we really think that this will help your internet experience? Do we really think that the government will make this better? What is the, other than the military, what does the government do well?
What you have to do is you have to contact the FCC and contact your representatives and tell them no net neutrality.
Yes, keep the internet free. The internet, like free enterprise, takes care of itself. Things that people don't want to see or hear about drops off the first page of an organic search, yes?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But things that people do want to read and see and hear about,
they have access to.
And they can read and decide for themselves what they consider to be true or not true based on the quality of the reporting.
One of the reasons that there have been so many issues against Obama or opportunities to speak out against Obama is the internet. And if they take that away or if they control that, he'll have just total free reign. And that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, Gene and Michael, I don't know if you guys do Facebook.
Yes.
Do you post on there how many cups of coffee you've had today?
No, I'm on all the military and the political sites, and I share them with all of my friends. And my friends actually like them, and they really, really enjoy that.
So. I'm just giving you a hard time there. But if you go on Facebook anymore, and when you go on so many of the pages, I mean, the rhetoric has been turned up. People
Absolutely.
Are just really expressing their outrage
against the radical Islam and against the things that the government's trying
yes.
to do. People are speaking out, and this is a great way to disseminate information so that Americans know what's going on in the country and what's being done to them.
So let's keep the internet free for all.
Okay. Next, I'd like to talk about Judge Andrew Hannon, our savior, wonderful man. He has issued an injunction against Obama's immigration policy to give amnesty to millions of illegals this week. And the policy was to go into effect on Wednesday, and it was put on hold. And Attorney General Eric Holder says that they will appeal the decision. And Obama says that the law is on their side. So I say this is chalk one up for the good guys, at least for now. The issue is the American people want the border sealed before anything else is done. No amnesty, no driver's licenses, etc. They definitely don't want citizenship for anyone who came here illegally. The president's agenda is to flood this country with uneducated people, and who will bring with them children who need to be educated and need health care, and all at taxpayers' expense. In addition, the Democrats want an army of voters who will register as Democrats. Americans don't have enough jobs available, so we are importing more people. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And where will we get these jobs?
And, you know, I can't help but think, Gene and Michael, that if citizens en masse would call or email and or email their elected officials and let them know that we're aware of this and that we vote. So what? You need this. This is an important
Several years ago, during Bush's administration, they were trying to pass comprehensive amnesty and immigration laws and so forth. And people went crazy, and all the talk shows encouraged people to call their representatives and so forth, and they did. And we were able to stop that. And it got so bad that some of the representatives and senators of their offices, they stopped answering the phone. Their voicemails were full. They weren't looking at their facts. They just ignored it. And but it didn't do them any good, because there were so many people that spoke up and contacted their representatives that they had to listen. And that was the way we stopped that way back when. And we can do it again. But you've got to do this on your own. Each individual has to call, write, email, fax their representatives and tell them that you don't want this.
Sounds like you're reminding us, Michael and Jean, that we live in a representative government.
We still do. Believe it or not, we still do.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is, though, that the majority no longer rules. One person rules. One person says, this offends me, and we eliminate it. The political correctness is incredible, that one person can stop everything, yet all of us together can't make something happen. We need to get involved and just pay attention. When you look at the fact that the White House said that the law is on their side, well, the judge said it's not. So by stating the law is on our side, that's dictatorial power. That's my way, the highway. I'm the king. I'm the monarch. I'm the dictator. This is it. You listen to me. You people are just not educated enough. You're not smart enough to know what's good for you. Only we know what's good for you.
And that's the key point, don't you guys think?
Absolutely. And I don't know if I'm the eternal optimist or what, but I have a feeling that this could be the first of many backlashes on Obama. I think we just might win this one.
Well, the law is on his side. I know. Yeah, what does that mean anymore, right?
Really?
But law is important, and nobody – this happens to be the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, when King John was forced to sign the concession, which really is the basis of freedom. But the law says that no one, including the king, is above the law. So let's throw that in as a reminder to our fellow Americans that no one is above the law. And in fact, this judge very well stated the president was acting legislatively, which he is not elected to do.
He does not have that power.
No.
An executive. Yes. Well, we're moving along in that same direction. Do you remember the children who had to be saved? You know, the ones who were attracted like moths to the flame of free entry into the United States due to persecution? Well, last I heard, the U.S. was actually flying planes down to Central America in order to fly the children directly here in the country, into our country. Anyways, many of these kids did need help, but I hate to say this, but it is not our responsibility to feed, clothe, and provide homes to the world. The problem is many of these children were actually adults masquerading as children. Many of them were terrorists. These terrorists are now in the United States, and we have no idea where they are. ISIS has recently bragged it has sleep cells in the U.S. ready to strike at a moment's notice. Isn't that special? Yeah. The effort to bring the children into the U.S. was not intended to be a humanitarian effort at all. No, the real agenda was to allow terrorists in and to gain more voters for the Democratic Party. This is also why the Obama administration has refused to seal the border. Report after report has shown light on the fact that terrorists are crossing our southern border and disappearing into the general population. The Washington Times reported recently that four Turkish terrorists were apprehended after crossing into the country from the south, and these are just the ones that we have caught. Just imagine how many have gotten through and disappeared without a trace, waiting to blow up a school or daycare center where your grandchildren go to be safe. Today we have news that the Obama administration wants to fly Syrian refugees into the United States from the fighting in the Middle East. Top U.S. counterterrorism officials say that they worry a potential terrorist could be hiding among the refugees. Oh, you think? And these refugees who are looking to come to the United States after escaping the brutal war in Syria. It's clearly a population of concern, they say, and it certainly is a population of concern. Also, there have been a great number of Somalian refugees who had been brought into the country previously. Again, we don't know who these people are. We don't know if they're terrorists or whatever. And here we go again. Same story, same agenda. As I've said before, it won't be until after Obama and his liberal friends in Congress who support him and his policies leave office that we uncover the damage he has wrought to this country. I hope the next administration is prepared to vet, investigate, and turn over rocks to eradicate this terrorist nemesis that Obama has implanted into our wonderful country.
Well said, Gene.
We thank you for listening today. And we invite all of you to come visit us at Brandywine Flags in the Marchwood Shopping Center in Exton, or visit us on the web, www.brandywineflags.com. We have everything from flags, flagpoles, accessories. We do repairs, service, all the different types of military, U.S., international, state, NASCAR flags, also the decorative flags for spring. I know that it's hard to believe, but the days are getting longer and the weather will be getting warmer. At some point, it will go above zero, I'm sure. It always does sometime in March. We look forward to having you visit us at the store. We'll talk with you next week. Thank you so much.